Federal
this
News
paid
Radio.
Program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. In an era when information and data have become major strategic assets, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, sits atop a vast array of both data and information that, if leveraged properly and applied innovatively, could transform health and healthcare delivery within this country. With advances in technology and the development of various collaborative platforms, we are witnessing a prime opportunity to make a vision of the future a reality of today. It is about encouraging innovators to use health data to develop applications that raise the awareness of health and health system performance and spark community action to improve health. And the HHS Office of Chief Technologist is pursuing such an effort. What is the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services technology innovation strategy? What is HHS doing to make data more accessible? How is HHS using technologies and innovations to meet its mission? And what is HHS doing to be more transparent, improve accountability, and increase opportunities for public engagement? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Brian Sebeck, Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So, Brian, before we kick off our conversation, I'd like to set some context with our guests. And so would you give us a brief overview of the history and mission of your department, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services?
Sure. So HHS, Department of Health and Human Services, is a massive organization. And keep in mind, I'm relatively new to the department. I started roughly 9 or 10 months ago or so. But what's really blown my mind since I've gotten there is just the breadth of the work that the department does. You got to understand, and most people I think don't realize this, but the department encompasses major agencies such as the National Institutes of Health, the Food and Drug Administration, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the largest insurance company in the world, essentially. I mean, this is a massive place. And what's also very interesting is that there are almost every group in the department really does touch the lives of every single American, pretty much. And so the scope is huge. The mission is incredibly important. And the breadth of things that we do is astonishing. And so it's been fascinating for me to get involved and to start to learn about some of the things that we do.
Yeah. And I want to know more about what you do. We can just jump to that. Could you give us a brief overview of the mission of HHS's Office of Chief Technologist? What was the genesis for creating this role? And perhaps you could highlight some of your specific responsibilities.
Sure. So the Office of the Chief Technology Officer, I guess is the right way to put it, was created a few years ago at the start of the Obama administration. And my predecessor, Todd Park, who's now the CTO for the United States in the White House, was the first CTO for the department. And really, you know, I think the role of the position has sort of evolved over time. Todd had a very large focus on this idea of liberating data from various places in the department, with the idea that that data could actually be utilized to affect massive transformations in the delivery of healthcare in this country, the ability to affect public health, and the delivery of human services, which are really the three main areas that the department focuses on. As I said, over time, the role has changed or evolved, I should say, a little bit. We still focus pretty heavily on data, but there are other areas that we look at as well. The way that I like to think about it is that we look at various assets that we have in the department and how and which assets are sort of undervalued or underutilized, and bring value or activate those assets to great effect. That's generally what we focus on.
So I've had a number of CIOs on, and lately, within the last year, I've had a number of CTOs on. For our purposes, what's the difference between a chief technologist or a chief technology officer and a chief information officer?
Good question. And I think it actually probably the answer to that probably depends on who you're talking to and what organization you're talking about. In HHS, our CIO is a guy named Frank Bateman, wonderful guy who, you know, is very forward thinking, has a lot of great ideas about how technology can be leveraged to better execute the mission of the department. His focus is really more, I would say, on the sort of internal, you know, pipes and plumbing and the things that make the system work, right? So this is everything from email to HR IT systems to financial systems to things like that. And so what Frank really focuses on in his role as CIO is, you know, how can we make the processes more efficient by using technology and by leveraging IT to do some of these things. One of the interesting things about my job in particular is that I actually have two titles. One title is Chief Technology Officer. The other title is Entrepreneur in Residence. And in many ways, I actually think the EIR side of my title is a little more descriptive of what I actually do. One thing I've learned over time, and I say this as a technologist and as a big geek, right, and somebody who loves technology and thinks that, you know, usually jumps to a technology solution is the first one because it's just how my brain works. But one of the things I've learned over time is that technology is rarely a solution to a problem. Technology can be an enabler. It can be a catalyst. It can be an accelerant. But it often needs to be sort of layered on top of some more fundamental change, which would be usually culture change or process change. And so that's where I think the EIR side of my job comes in. And a lot of what we're focusing on right now is how to actually affect cultural change within the department so that we can put technology on top of it and actually make things better.
And you are an entrepreneur. I mean, your background is such, right?
Yeah. I started a company in 97 in San Francisco, enterprise software company, and moved over to London in 2005 to start up the European and Asian operations for the company. So I have entrepreneur blood, I guess, is one way to phrase it.
Well, you know, think about your responsibilities and your role. And I know you've been there for about 10 months, correct? And what are your three top challenges that you've faced, and how have you sought to address those challenges?
So, you know, I think the biggest challenge really that we run into is just the sort of culture of government, right? So I was saying before that the way I look at what our office does is to find undervalued assets or underutilized assets across the department and recognize the value in those things. And if I look at data as sort of the initial effort that we undertook for this, I think, you know, you can definitely look at it from that perspective. We have massive amounts of data stored within the department that we either collect or create or curate. And there is a huge amount of potential to be realized if we can make that data open and available. So starting 3 years ago, starting with Todd and my group, we, you know, embarked on this mission to essentially change the dynamic around the culture of data sharing in the department. And I think we've been very successful in that. The default setting is definitely now moved from closed to open, and people do absolutely think about and understand the value in putting data out there. And so I think if we look at sort of that process as an analog to other processes that we might undertake to recognize value in other assets, the one that I have really been thinking a lot about recently is the asset of people, right? Mm-hmm. So I mentioned in the beginning that the department is massive, right? And it's massive not just in terms of the things we do, but in terms of the number of people. We have about 90,000 people that work at the department. You got to understand that this is a government institution, right? It's a very structured, siloed, sort of command and control oriented organization. And that definitely has its benefits. There are some things that operate very well in that environment. At the same time, it is somewhat stifling in terms of the potential for, you know, creative thought or experimentation. These are the things that we're really focused on trying to enable. If we can teach people how to experiment and give them the freedom to experiment, what we believe will be a direct result of that is innovation. In fact, that's the definition of innovation that I'm working with right now. I kind of hate the word innovation, decided that I'm not a huge fan of it because it doesn't really mean a whole lot. What we're saying is that we believe that innovation is the direct result of this freedom to experiment. So if I can teach people how to experiment, not only can I do that because there is a methodology to experimentation, but it also encodes the ability for an unsuccessful experiment to happen, which I think is a critical thing for government to be able to do. And then secondly, I can teach you how to experiment. I can allow for this possibility of unsuccessful experiments, but I can also give you the freedom to do that by, you know, creating some space for experimentation to happen. And so that's really a lot of what we focus on when it comes to recognizing the value in the people that we have in the department.
So I know, though you've only been at HHS in your current role for a fairly short amount of time, you're not new to government. I mean, you did a stint at D.C. and Maryland as well. Mm-hmm. Leading innovation, a word that you're not too particularly fond of, but nonetheless, in such an expansive department, can be fraught with unanticipated surprises. What has surprised you since taking your role?
One thing that surprised me when I first got into government a few years ago in D.C., I came in with the stereotypical view of the government bureaucrat, right? The clock-punching bureaucrat who did nothing but, you know, write out a pension. And, you know, I think that's the popular concept, right, and perspective on what happens inside government. And what I found, and this has literally repeated itself in D.C. and in Maryland and now in HHS, is that I have met and worked with now some of the smartest and most dedicated people I've ever had the opportunity to come into contact with in my life. And that gives me great hope, right? Because most of the people that, you know, if you work for government, you're working for government not because you're getting paid a lot of money. You're doing it typically for the right reasons. And so that's been a huge surprise for me, just given my initial kind of sort of stereotypical view coming in. That's also why I really believe that if we can leverage some of that and some of that potential, we can achieve amazing things.
Well, I often ask my guests with similar backgrounds as yourself in terms of played in the private sector and now they're in government. To that end, given your experience, what makes an effective leader? What are some of the qualities of an effective leader?
Okay, so a few things. First of all, you have to be willing to take some chances. And I don't mean, you know, wild, crazy bets, right? I mean, you know, intelligent, thoughtful acceptance of risk in order to try to move the ball forward in certain areas. Secondly, you have to give people that work for you the freedom to execute their responsibilities, and then hold them accountable for those for that execution. One of the things that government has a big problem with is giving people space and letting people kind of do things. You mentioned D.C. As my first government job, and I think one of the great things about Mayor Fenty, who was the mayor that brought me on board, was that he recognized that the right way to do things would be to hire good people and just let them do their jobs. And when you look at the amount of things that happened under the Fenty administration and the sort of way that the city moved forward, I think that you can see the effect of that. And I think that's a really effective trait in a leader. This is something that exists in spades at the department. When I was talking to the secretary and the deputy secretary about the job in the first place, it became abundantly clear that that was sort of how they operated as well. I wouldn't have taken the job if it wasn't the case. And so far, it's been absolutely true. They are great people to work for because they absolutely get that fact. Second thing, and I'll quote one of my other old bosses, Governor O'Malley here. He likes to point out that if you can't measure something, you can't manage it. Data and the analysis of data as it relates to very specific goals that get set out are critical to managing an operation. And I think that's something that more governments need to kind of pay attention to. In government in general, we have really a few levers that we can pull, but not too many. And the thing is, if we can figure out how to set goals, very specific goals and very measurable goals, and then pull the levers that we can pull, and then track how those pulling, how the pulling of those levers actually affect our progress towards that goal, then you actually have much more information to start to make decisions. And so I think that's another key trait, is looking at the initiatives that you undertake and how those initiatives actually help you achieve certain goals that you set out ahead of time.
What is the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services technology innovation strategy? We will ask Brian Seebeck, Chief Technology Officer at HHS, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Is there a recipe for successful cross-agency collaborations that are enduring? Or is each initiative so dependent on context and personality that there's no way to offer general principles of success? Well, an IBM Center report by Dr. Jane Fountain, Implementing Cross-Agency Collaborations, a Guide for Federal Managers, offers advice on successful cross-agency relationships. Fountain says there's, in fact, a recipe for success, but it depends on the number of factors. Go to businessofgovernment.org, download Jane Fountain's report, and find out. That's businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Brian Seebeck, Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So, Brian, you've mentioned that one of your roles is to really uncover the value of, say, data and people in your institution. And so, in a sense, you have to promote innovation to do that and some innovative ideas. I had a question around your technology strategy, but I really want to get your vision and how you're going to do that. How are you, in your role, doing exactly what you said your mission is, and that is uncover that value that maybe not so accessible now?
So I think you take that in two pieces, right? We'll start with the data piece. So over the last 3 years, as I mentioned, we've spent a lot of time and focused a lot of effort on this idea of data liberation, changing that default setting from closed to open. Been, as I said, very successful. We have a website, healthdata.gov, where we publish essentially a catalog of all of the liberated data sets across the department. And we have over 400 data sets listed there out of, I think, our rough tally of what's available is around 1,000. And we progress, you know, every day in terms of finding out where these additional data sets are and helping people understand that there's value in putting that out there. So that's sort of been the first focus for the first few years. What we're moving into now, I would say, is sort of a second phase where we're trying to think about how we recognize the value that's inherent in that data. Mm-hmm. And so we're really looking at three sort of main areas of effort here. Number one is we'll continue the data liberation efforts, although I think it's going from more of a sort of shotgun-style approach to a sniper rifle approach, right? We'll figure out, like, what the specific data sets are that we need to liberate and work to liberate those, as opposed to the broad call of saying, hey, you know, who's got data? Bring it in. The next piece is dissemination, right? So how do we continue to get the data out there in better ways? And I mentioned healthdata.gov. You know, the site is essentially right now a catalog for the data sets that exist within the department. One of the ways of getting data out there in a better way is using what's called an application programming interface, or API. What that does is it allows developers to access data sets programmatically, as opposed to having to download a data set, load it into their program, and then refresh that over time, right? What an API provides is real-time access in machine-readable form and programmatic fashion to the data. So we have, I think, 34 or so data sets that are API-enabled right now, and we're constantly trying to figure out which ones are more important and to make those more available via API. So that's sort of the dissemination side. And there are other things we're working on with the platform itself to try to make it more sort of friendly to getting information out there, to having conversations around it, that kind of thing. The third area is what I'm calling data education. In the Department of Health and Human Services, like many other places, we suffer from what I'll call the expert problem. You know, we know this stuff so well, and there's such a massive set of terminology and lingo associated with it that we forget sometimes, I think, that there are lots of people out there who could do interesting things with our assets that don't speak the same language we do. You know, there's a great example that I use all the time. There's a data set on that's listed on our website called the National Plan and Provider Enumeration System. When you read the first sentence of the description of that data set on our website. You know, I'll read this out at a conference to a room full of people actually who probably are subject matter experts. And literally three people will raise their hands when I ask them if they know what that is, right? Turns out that this is not quite an accurate statement, but it's pretty much an accurate statement. This data set is pretty much a list of all of the doctors in the United States with their associated specialties and where they are. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's a very useful data set. You wouldn't know it from the title or the first sentence of the description. And so, you know, I use that all the time because it's a great example of, you know, some of the work that we have to do to translate, I think, these sort of the way we frame things and the way we phrase things into words that other people can understand. So this is the data education piece. So that's, you know, one is making sort of democratizing our materials. A second piece to that is actually teaching people how to use the data in better ways. So one of the things we're working on right now is we're talking to an organization called Codecademy, which is an online, relatively new site that teaches people how to code. And what we want to do is create a series of classes that teach people how to utilize the data that we have, give them examples of where it can be used, what some of the fields mean, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And so we're experimenting with different ways of getting that out there. So that's the data side. Then on the people side, and how, you know, the question is, how do we recognize the value in people? This is tricky because what this really means is culture change. And culture change is probably the hardest thing that you'll ever attempt to do. You know, it's easy to, you know, throw a piece of technology on top of something and hope that it works. It's much, much harder to get people to change. Change is hard. So what we're doing is really approaching this from a somewhat systematic perspective, building a framework of a series of programs that will hopefully get us to this sort of overarching goal. The first layer of this is what I'll call a foundational layer. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big believer in collaboration. I think when you look at the history of innovation, or of disruptive innovation in particular, one of the things that really jumps out is that there are very few, if any, sort of eureka moments, right? What tends to happen is that people who have these sort of breakthrough ideas, it's really a culmination of years or decades spent reading and studying different materials, but also having lots of people with different backgrounds and different experiences and different cultures all sort of collectively collaborating on a problem. Tony Hsieh, who's the CEO and founder of Zappos, likes to call this a serendipitous collision, right? And so one of the things that I think you can take that phrase serendipitous collision and sort of bake that into the concept of collaboration in general. So one of the things that we're really focused on in this foundational layer is enabling collaboration across the department. And that exists in really two parts. One is the physical. If you walk into an HHS building today and, you know, walk down a hallway and open a door and go into like where people actually work, what you'll see are basically cubes that go to the sky and doors that are shut and nobody wandering around. So the potential for serendipitous collisions are minimized. So one of the things that we're looking at doing is creating actually a physical space called HHS Labs, which think about it like a Silicon Valley style co-working space where, you know, all of the furniture is modular, there are no walls, every surface is writable. And I'm not talking about building some crazy expensive thing out here. I'm talking about, you know, going to IKEA and buying some cheap furniture on wheels that you can push around. And you know, it doesn't matter if it gets dinged up, right? We're not talking about building something fancy. We're talking about building something with low barrier to connection. So that's one side of it. Then the other side is what I'll call a virtual collaboration space. So about 6 months ago, we launched a internal collaboration network across the department. We had the secretary announce it to sort of give her validation that this is something that we wanted to do. We've been working to increase adoption and engagement on this. Again, this is, you know, it's hard. It's culture change. But we've seen some pretty remarkable stuff start to happen. You know, people asking questions that would not have normally asked questions, or people at various levels in the department interacting that never would have interacted before. And so these are great things. So that's the foundational layer. On top of that, we want to identify people, the ones of the, you know, the people who are part of this 90,000 who are ready to be activated, the early adopters, if you will. And so we're launching two programs which are focused on this identification. One is called HHS Ignite, which is, think of it like seed funding for startup ideas. And we're just about to roll that out. And then the other program we're calling HHS Fair Trade, which I think the easiest way to think about this is it's like Kickstarter internally. And so what we're looking at trying to do is trying to help connect people who have ideas but need resources to implement those ideas, not necessarily money, but mainly people and skills, right? So let's say I have an idea for a website that could do something to help my mission, but I don't know how to code, I don't know how to design anything, and I don't know how to set up a server, right? But I know that there are people in the department who know how to do those things and probably would be interested in helping me on this this mission. And so what we want to do is set up a platform that allows people to put out these ideas, much like Kickstarter, and have other folks say, oh yeah, I know how to code, I'll help you out with this thing. And if they get all of their commitments, you know, in place, then cash in on those commitments and everybody starts working on the problem. So that's the identification layer. On top of that, and believing, again, as I mentioned, that these sort of disruptive innovations come from this collision of ideas, we want to bring external people into the mix as well. And so we have two programs there. One is called HHS Entrepreneurs, which is call it a sort of an entrepreneur in residence program. We have essentially some hand-selected high-risk, high-reward projects that exist across the department. And when I say hand-select, I mean the secretary will select the things that she thinks are important. And what we then do is bring external people in for a period of a year, no more, no less, to actually work on solving these problems. And that has two benefits. One, we get new ideas into the mix that we probably wouldn't have otherwise. Number two, you have some people that are not necessarily bound by some of the bureaucratic handcuffs that folks on the inside are, and are able to prove that there are better ways of doing things. And so this is sort of a, you know, injecting new concepts into the mix. The other external area that we focus on is a program called HHS Competes, which is our prizes and challenges program. And the idea behind Competes is that basically leverages the American Competes Act. We've done over 100 challenges in the department, given away millions of dollars for good ideas and good solutions to problems. And the, you know, we want to continue to do that as well, because that just brings lots of new ideas into the mix. Then the final component is what I consider to be sort of the viral engine of change, if you will. And this is called HHS Innovates. And what this program does is actually recognizes those people in the department who have done something interesting. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily something that works, right? Or something that has solved a problem. Maybe it's in the process of solving a problem, but have tried to do things in different ways. And, you know, we have this great ceremony. The secretary does pictures with the teams. And these are, you know, teams of people from deep in the organization, usually. They get plaques. Everybody gets a small check. But the money is actually the least important part of this, right? It's really the recognition of trying something new and actually sort of being recognized for, you know, taking a chance and taking a risk. And so that's really the framework. And so we believe that if we can, you know, implement these programs and then track, you know, their progress, we will be able to start to affect this idea of culture change across the department.
It's very clear. And you can see it. I think it's very interesting. I'd like to touch on the data for a second.
Sure.
And in particular, you sit atop a vast array of data. What's the benefits of democratizing access to this data?
I think there are any number of potential benefits. And a lot of it depends on what data you're talking about in particular. You know, historically, if you look at data that the government has either collected or created or curated, there have been some great examples of literally industries that have been created out of liberating data. So weather and GPS are the two commonly used examples, right? The government let all this weather data go, and now you have, you know, hundreds of weather apps on tablets and smartphones. You have the Weather Channel. You have, you know, all kinds of stuff. Better models for predicting weather come from this. GPS is obviously another great example, right? Every device that you can think of now has a GPS chip in it, which wouldn't have been possible had the government not allowed access to both the system and the data. So, you know, I think that's one area. There's tons of new potential developments that could happen based on putting this data out there. Some sort of smaller things, but no less important. A company called iTriage built in a smartphone app that uses that data set I was talking about before as one example of the list of doctors. And they've actually literally been able to save people's lives, right? Because somebody might be having a heart attack or something else and open up the application to find the number for the ER or the closest doctor or what have you, right? I mean, they have a bunch of stories like that. So that's fascinating. Look at things like Medicare claims data, right? If that data can be analyzed robustly, either on its own or with other claims data sets, you can imagine dramatically reducing the cost of care or finding out new things that you wouldn't have otherwise found out about how care is actually provided. And so, you know, I think the sky's the limit. And usually when people ask me questions like that, my typical answer is, I have no idea, right? Because what we've seen time and time and time again is that there are tons of creative people out there that, when given this information, can do amazing things with it that you would never even imagine. Actually, I'll give you one other great example of that. There was recently a data set or a section of a data set, a section of the Medicare claims data set that was requested by a third party, an external developer. And basically all they wanted to know was the that data set, the MPPES data set that I was talking about before. What it really one of the things it contains is this national provider identifier, which is essentially a unique identifier for a doc. Basically. And so what this guy asked for was when a patient is referred by one doctor to another, in the claims record, there is a one field which says the referring doctor and the one field which notes the doctor that the patient gets referred to. And they're noted by this NPI number. And so what he asked for was just the list of all of the referring those two doctors in each one of those cases, with the idea that you could potentially build the social graph of doctors based on these two numbers, right? Which is a fascinating thing to think about, because that could mean, you know, that could be any number of things, right? You could say, well, if you know, Dr. A gets a ton of referrals for this one particular procedure, maybe he's really, really good at that,
yeah.
Right? And then we can start to look at outcomes and say, you know, is this doctor really that good? Maybe there are some other things that you could find out from this data set. But it's just like a really clever idea that nobody ever had before, right? And it occurred to somebody that they could take these two pieces of data, these two numbers, and potentially draw some really interesting conclusions out of it. So I think, I have no idea. I think amazing things can happen if we just let it go.
So I'd like to talk about the other part of the framework that you've described, and that is sort of my take on it, your ability to cultivate innovation and more particularly risk-taking. And you alluded to the programs that you have in place to do that, HHS Innovates and HHS Entrepreneurs and the competition efforts. Could you tell us a little bit, maybe share with us some of the lessons you've learned to make those programs better or more effective, or even more importantly, any interesting anecdotes or illustrations of key success stories associated with them?
So one of my favorite HHS Innovate success stories is the CDC did a Center for Disease Control and Prevention did a advertising campaign. Maybe that's a crass way to put it, but that's really what it was. One of their functions is to promote emergency preparedness in the population, right? So hurricanes coming through, have your water, have your flashlights and batteries and, you know, extra food and all that kind of stuff. And so they wanted to do something kind of fun to promote this, something that might have, you know, it might be more viral than just like the, hey, government says you should be prepared. So they actually created this campaign, which was basically telling people to be prepared for the zombie apocalypse. This is, you know, zombies are popular. Everybody loves a zombie. So they created this campaign. A couple of statistics about this campaign, right? This was an advertising campaign that cost $87.
Fascinating.
Okay. Total of $87. And in its first week of being put out there, generated 3.6 billion impressions. Okay. Now that's a good ROI metric. I think any advertiser would kill for that. But you got to understand that this is not quite the CDC's image, right? This is not necessarily the kind of thing that they espouse. And so these guys took a risk, right? They put something out there that was not necessarily part of the culture, and it did amazingly well. And actually, I like to play this clip for people. Unfortunately, this is radio, so it's not not going to work as well. But there's a you can search for this. It's on the clip's on YouTube. But there a few weeks ago, the Canadian Parliament, literally, you know, in the Canadian Parliament, debated the zombie apocalypse and thanked their friends at the CDC for bringing this to their attention. I mean, it's a brilliant clip. It's hilarious. Strongly encourage everybody to go search for the Canadian Parliament debating the zombie apocalypse. But that, to me, was the culmination of, you know, the fact that these things really can work.
$87.
Right? $87. And so these guys were one of the winners of HHS Innovates, you know, which is great, because what that does is it sends the message that these kinds of things are valuable, and we want people to continue to experiment with new ideas that are not necessarily part of the common culture. And the fact that the secretary handed them an award that recognized their efforts here really said from the top down, we value this type of experimentation. We value this type of
validation.
Exactly.
So can I ask, you're an entrepreneur in residence, and when you look at the HHS Entrepreneurs Program, what qualities are you looking for?
It totally depends, actually, on the project itself. Although I would say that the one main characteristic of the entrepreneur that we bring in, we want somebody who is willing to take a risk, who is willing to push the envelope, who can intelligently question the status quo and say, look, you know, in order for me to accomplish what I'm here to do in this limited period of time, we have to think about how to do things differently. So I'd say that's the key trait, right? But depending on the project itself, you know, maybe we're looking for somebody who knows how to write code. One of our projects right now is all about bringing lean manufacturing techniques into one of our processes. So we brought in a lean expert who had that other characteristic as well. One of our projects, which is fascinating, it's to sort of make the organ donor transplant network much more modernized and less prone to error. We brought somebody in who's a logistics expert from UPS, right? I mean, so there's all kinds of, you know, backgrounds that I think are valuable for this, just depending on what the project actually is.
How is HHS cultivating a culture of innovation and collaboration? We will ask Brian Sivak, Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Pundits warn about the fiscal cliff, but federal agencies nearly every year hold up the budgetary sky while walking on the edge of a cliff. It's called the world of continuing resolutions and potential government shutdowns. The IBM Center report, The Cost of Budgetary Uncertainty, Analyzing the Impact of Late Appropriations by Dr. Phil Joyce, examines the impact of late budgets on the efficiency and effectiveness of government operations. To find out more about the cost of budgetary uncertainty, go to businessofgovernment.org. That's businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Brian Sivak, Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So you mentioned, we talked about the culture, transforming the culture, and we also talked about the importance of collaboration and innovation. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about that, sort of delve into the collaboration aspect. What tools and platforms are you folks exploiting and exploring to actually create a culture of collaboration within your department?
So I would actually rephrase that question a little bit, right? It's not that we are using tools to create a culture, right? We're trying to create a culture that can leverage tools.
Okay.
And that sort of gets back to my earlier point about how technology is not really a solution to problems, but it can be an enabler. The collaboration platform that we set up is a platform called Yammer. Many people have heard of it. And we chose it really because it was relatively easy for us to choose. We already had a contract with them through NIH, and they had sort of procured it in such a way that we could roll it out across the department if we wanted to. So it was a sort of easy and natural choice for us to make. What's been interesting about it is, you know, it's not enough to just say, here, hey, we've got this tool, use it, right? It has to be, first of all, valuable for people. Secondly, it has to become part of their sort of day-to-day workflow. And so we've been experimenting with different ways to sort of create engagement and adoption of the platform. So an example, we had a theory that if there was a department-wide event or moment in time that was relevant and interesting enough for a discussion to happen across the department, then this could be a great way to have that discussion. And so it just so happened a few months ago, we were at the end of open enrollment for the federal health benefits plan, which obviously touches everybody in the department. And so we thought, hey, let's get the benefits experts to do a Yammer town hall, right? Or I think they call it a Yam Jam, to see if we can get people, you know, engaged in using the platform and to you know, use this as an example of how it can be valuable. And so we set this up. We got a couple of benefits experts to participate in this thing. You know, a lot of them were skeptical, but we found a couple that were really interested in this. And we marketed it. What was interesting is that we usually get, I would say on average, probably 60 or 70 new people signing up a day for this thing because, you know, people, they tell their friends and, you know, they get people on board. We announced that we were going to do this town hall right the day after we announced it, we had 744 people sign up. Really? The next day, we had about 600 people sign up. And then we had the town hall, and it was fascinating to watch because, first of all, there were a ton of people participating in the discussion. Lots of people had questions about health plans and how it works and all kinds of stuff. So the benefits experts, those two that we had recruited to this effort, quickly got overwhelmed. But what was neat was that their colleagues actually jumped on and started answering questions. But what was even neater was that other people, random people across the department, started answering other people's questions, right? So, for example, somebody posted a question about the quality of the docs in a certain specialty in a specific plan or something. You know, I think it was a Kaiser plan that they were looking at. And somebody wrote back and said, hey, I have Kaiser. It's been great. You know, I have this experience and that experience. And so it was just amazing. And, yeah, and these people had never met each other. They had no idea who they were, right? But now we're able to allow them to collaborate and work together on a specific problem because we have this thing in place. So we're undertaking a bunch of different experiments like that to see if there are different things that we can do that will increase both adoption and engagement.
So, you know, part of that, you mentioned stakeholder input. How are you, in your role throughout the department, gauging that, taking some of their insights in and transforming the way either you do business or the way things are done in the department?
And that's another good question. So one thing I think that we do need to think about is better feedback mechanisms. You know, we have some standard stuff in place around commenting on regulations and commenting on legislation and things like that. But I think we need, you know, better feedback loops. Now, we are a little this is where it gets tricky with some of the regulations and laws that actually exist, because it turns out we can't actually solicit feedback from people in groups larger than nine. You know, there are a bunch of weird rules out there. And I guess I understand why this is the Paperwork Reduction Act, the PRA. I guess I understand why what the impetus was for the development of the PRA. But in the world we live in today, where we actually could get useful and valuable information from people out there, it makes a lot less sense. And so, you know, we need to think about ways of changing some of these laws so that we can actually affect better feedback mechanisms. I literally can't put a web survey out there that goes to more than 10 people without going through this very long and onerous process to get things approved. And so, you know, we're working to figure out how we can change stuff like that because, you know, we have to – one of the things we have to do in government is recognize that the world moves quickly, right? And especially when it comes to technology enabling communication and collaboration and input and all of this kind of stuff. And we are a representative democracy, so we should value all of those things. We have to figure out ways of moving a little bit faster when it comes to actually doing that. And so I think this is a key kind of component to, again, this culture change, right? I don't think it would hurt to experiment. Again, it's this word experiment, right? We don't necessarily have to put all of our chips into one bucket, right? Like we can make little bets and we can say, you know, hey, let's give this a shot and see if it works. And if it doesn't, let's figure out why it didn't and fold that back into the next iteration of our experiments. And I think there's a million different things that we can do around these areas that would actually prove the point.
A wonderful portfolio management approach in a sense. You have a portfolio of some winners, some losers. And
exactly.
So, Brian, given your background and your current role, I'd like to talk a little bit about big data, the phenomenon of big data. Sure. What is HHS doing to tackle this challenge, and what are some of the steps being taken to better manage and store and collect data?
So I have this thing about technology buzzwords. I have this theory that once my mother has heard of a term, it's sort of jumped the shark a little bit, right? The first one was cloud. Now I would say we're sort of in that phase with big data. It's another one of those terms that doesn't really mean a whole lot. I think it's the buzzword du jour. There are different ways of thinking about it. So, you know, at NIH, just as an example, they're about to embark on a project, as we've all heard, to map the human brain. Mm-hmm. When you look at the amount of data that that project is going to have to both collect and store and analyze, I mean, it's mind-blowing, right? And so you could throw that into the big data bucket, no doubt. And, you know, they're going to have to develop new technologies in order to figure out how to do that stuff, which I think is one of the key goals of the program. The genomic data that they maintain, or that we actually in a bunch of different places maintains, that's, you know, again, different type of data, you know, doesn't change as quickly. It's not necessarily as real time, but does require, you know, lots of storage and lots of processing capabilities. And so, you know, that's another thing that we're working on. Across the department, you know, we have lots of sets of data that we need to think about and need to look at. And, you know, there's lots of different efforts that we're undertaking. I would say the cutting edge stuff that's happening right now is really in NIH, because they do have the biggest problems when it comes to, you know, how to deal with a sort of onslaught of rapidly changing, massively generated sets of data. So, you know, I think you need to look at it on a case-by-case basis, really, to answer that question in the right way.
What does the future hold for technology and innovation at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services? We will ask its Chief Technology Officer, Brian Sivak, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. This is The Center This Week, highlighting the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness. Brought to you by the IBM Center for the Business of Government. I'm Michael Keegan, Managing Editor of the Business of Government magazine. The Center This Week is our opportunity to inform and, most importantly, to invite you, our listeners, to use the IBM Center for the Business of Government as your resource, a how-to resource for improving government effectiveness at the state, local, and federal level. Advances in biomedical research seek to enhance health and length of life and reduce the burdens of illness and disability. The National Institutes of Health, NIH, plays a significant role in making this happen. U.S. life expectancy has increased dramatically over the past century. Not only are people living longer, they're living healthier lives. However, as Dr. Francis Collins, director of NIH, notes, science is not a 100-yard dash. It's a marathon run by a relay team that includes researchers, patients, industry experts, lawmakers, and the public. Dr. Collins outlines how basic research prompted a revolution in the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of diseases, and what NIH is doing to advance biomedical research.
NIH spends about 53% of its budget on basic research, and that would be defined as research on some aspect of biological processes that does not have an immediate implication or application to a disease. But you have to understand how life works at the most fundamental level before you can really understand what disease is all about. So this is the foundation of everything we do. And over the course of many decades, the basic science research, which has led to no less than 135 Nobel Prizes for NIH-funded grantees, is the way in which we've often then gotten to the next level of understanding about a biological process, and that in turn has led to insights about disease, which are now making big differences clinically. If we want to continue to see those medical advances going forward 10, 20, 30 years from now, we need to be doing the basic science now that is going to provide that foundation.
In the end, it's about turning discovery into action, which, though necessary, is quite risky. Here's Dr. Collins.
By having now made those basic discoveries, we're poised to be able to translate that into action. And that is, in fact, a major focus of a new center at NIH, the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences. There are a number of steps that you want to follow once you understand the molecular basis of a disease. They're complicated, they're failure-prone, they're risky. But we know increasingly how to do that. And that's a great example of how, at the present time, the basic science informs the translation. I should say, this is also a virtuous circle, that when you make an observation at the basic level that leads you to clinical insight, sometimes when you try this out clinically, you learn something about the basics as well. And you go around that virtuous circle to your benefit over and over again.
How does the new National Center for Advancing Translational Science work to make all this a reality? Dr. Collins elaborates.
So NCATS, this National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, was very much founded on the need to try to identify what are those systematic bottlenecks that cause this process to be so challenging. And it is. The average time it takes to go from a good idea about a new treatment to getting that drug approved is 14 years. The failure rate is well over 99%. Now, an engineer looking at a pipeline like that would say, come on, there must be something better you could do here to improve success and shorten the time. And that's what NCATS aims to do, to look systematically in a way that no single project focus would achieve, Where are the bottlenecks? Where are the things where we lose momentum, where time goes by more than it should, where failure rates are way too high? Could we take some of the new science that's coming forward in the last few years and really re-engineer that pipeline? That's what we're trying to do.
Why is the work that NIH does so important? Here's Dr. Francis Collins.
I would say there has never been a better time in all of history than right now to come and join this enterprise. We are unraveling mysteries that have puzzled us for all of human history. We're poised to take that information to the next level in terms of preventing and treating disease. We have the chance to bring the basic and the clinical aspects of research together in a very tight connection and a virtuous circle. This would be the moment if you're in any way inclined to get involved in a great detective story that has great answers, come and join the biomedical research team. We've got stuff for you to do.
More information on this and other center resources is available at businessofgovernment.org. There you will find how the business of government is not business as usual. For the IBM Center for the Business of Government, I'm Michael Keegan, and this has been The Center This Week. How do leaders direct ambitious change and achieve significant goals? What strategies do they use to overcome opposition and win allies? And how do specific organizational and political contexts affect strategies and outcomes? These are important age-old questions. To help answer them, the IBM Center has released Forging Governmental Change by Professor Harry Lambright. Lambright has identified two premier government leaders, Dr. Robert Gates of DOD and Dr. Francis Collins of NIH, who have led transformations within their own organizations. By all accounts, both men have been effective leaders of change. This report continues the IBM Center's long interest in leadership and transformation. So go to businessofgovernment.org and download Forging Governmental Change, Lessons from Transformations Led by Robert Gates and Francis Collins. That's businessofgovernment.org. There you can download all Center reports and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Brian Sivak, Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So switching to the future, given our conversation, I know we talked about innovation, and I had Dr. Levin on from the time he was the CTO at VA, and we chatted about the idea of controlled innovation. What's your perspective on that?
If I'm understanding what the phrase controlled innovation means, what I would say is that I think it's important to provide some guideposts or some stakes in the ground, if you will, where people can kind of focus their thoughts and efforts. You know, it's one thing for me to say to somebody, come up with a new idea to transform healthcare in the United States, right? It's pretty broad. But I could say something maybe more specific, like come up with a new idea to help reduce a variation in costs for knee replacement surgery in different geographic regions. I think that focusing of the topic will cause people to come up with potentially better solutions. I think you'll still have some people that think big and deep about, you know, massive issues. But I think, you know, it's much, much more effective to focus people's thinking on specific topics at hand. A great example, actually, is codathons. Mm-hmm. The most successful codathons that we've seen or been involved with are ones that are focused on a very specific issue. So say childhood obesity, right? If you can get people together and say, hey, we're looking at focusing on childhood obesity and here's a bunch of data sets that you can use to help solve that problem, go, right? Then they'll actually come up with some focused solutions. But if you say, we're trying to fix healthcare.
Yeah, it's too big.
Yeah.
So as we continue on the future, what emerging technologies hold the most promise for improving the work you folks do, and beyond that, the federal government?
So one of the things that we focus a lot on is the prevalence of sensors, right? So sensors become, as they become more ubiquitous and even smaller and less power hungry and things like that, we're going to start to see, I think, a massive change in the way that we understand and analyze the world around us. So, you know, on me at any given moment in time, I have any number of sensors, right? I've got in my phone a GPS chip. I've got an accelerometer. I've got access to sort of temperature and weather sensors, right? I have a Fitbit in my pocket, which detects both, again, another it's got another accelerometer in it, but it also detects steps and stairs that I climb and things like that. And so I'm constantly generating these streams of data that, when analyzed in the right way, will help me both understand myself, my actions, and the world I live in.